Toymaker. Hostile takeover. It's like the punchline to a knock-knock joke gone wrong. Knock-knock. Who's there? I was looking for Mike. Is he in? Please step inside, sir. Do you have some form of ID? You are not stupid. You aren't carrying anything illegal on your person. It's all in your head. Even your Fall Guy phone is only guilty of behaving in a shifty manner. So you do not attempt to flee. Instead, you do as the uniformed gentleman requests and meekly step into the front hall to help him with his inquiries, whereupon you realize that something is very wrong indeed, because the walls and ceiling and floor are covered in clear plastic anti-contamination sheets, and there's a scene of crime officer in a bunny suit coming down the stairs. "Will a driving license do?" you ask the cop. You can see him giving you the quick up and down with his glasses, which is an oh-shit moment. "What's your name?" he asks. "John. John Christie," you volunteer, reaching for your wallet. "Is Mike here? Is there some kind of problem?" You force an expression of worried concern, a little apprehension. Under the circumstances, it comes easily enough. "A driving license will do. Pass it here, please." You fumble the card and slide it towards him. Most of the John Christie ID is loaded in your phone. From microcredits to bank accounts, it's very solid. "Why are you here?" "I was hoping to see Mike." You slow your spiel as if uncertain, even though any fool can tell that something has gone seriously non-linear here. You make an effort to memorize the Dibble's nameplate, P.C. Brown, presumably working for Inspector Scarlet of Rainbow Division. Just your luck you aren't wearing a life logger, or you could stand on your rights a little harder. But no, that might not be a good idea. Every instinct is telling you to disengage. Mike's obviously in big trouble, which means you won't be hiring him, that's for sure. You need to get clear before the cops start focusing on you. A factoid pops out of the Mike Blair file and screams for your attention, and you instantly realize it's a good one. "He said to drop by if I was ever in Edinburgh." P.C. Brown turns your driving license over in his hand, and you can see some flickering in his glasses. He's got a contactless reader, online to the DVLA database and then back to cop space once they've authenticated it. The photograph matches, and the license is genuine. He glances back at you and twitches his head, superimposing a head-up ghost image beside your face. Then he hands the card back. "Where did you meet Mr. Mike?" "It was at the Admiral Duncan in London about 6 months ago. Or maybe eight. Or was it after Pride? Anyway, we, got to know each other quite well." You clear your throat. "It's personal. He invited me to drop round if I was ever in Edinburgh, and I'm here for the next week on business, and I was hoping he didn't have anything else on for the weekend." "Is something wrong?" Brown's expression morphs through a whole sequence of emotions as you give him the big lie, backed up by some telegraphic wiggling of eyebrows and seasoned with just the tiniest bit of camp. You haven't, in fact, ever met Mike, and you hope to hell he's lying dead in an autopsy room so he can't contradict you. Even if you had, you wouldn't want to fuck him. On the other hand, the operations files went into quite a lot of detail on the subject of his personal life, and getting off with him after a pride march in what has long been one of the biggest knocking shops in London is entirely plausible. The Scottish police get all red-faced and sweaty at the merest suggestion of locker room homophobia. It's amusing to watch the cop switch from investigating person of interest mode to dealing with bereaved significant other in the space of a sentence. It works even better if there is some latent locker room homophobia, so you're careful to lean just a little too close and hold the eye contact a second too long. "Is something wrong?" you ask, feigning worry as he begins to open his mouth. And you know that really nothing is wrong. If you were neurotypical and going up against the speech stress analysis he's watching in his fancy-pants glasses, you'd be in deep doo-doo, getting flustered from all the falsehoods. But you're not, and the cop's sexy tech passes the handicap to their side when they get to deal with the likes of you. It's only if they get you in front of a psych with a PCLR checklist that you've got to start worrying. "Mr. Christie, John, I'm really sorry." He takes a deep breath. "Would you like to sit down?" He's all solicitude, waving you into the spotless kitchen, which is interestingly bereft of forensic turds. "I'm very sorry, but..." "Oh, God," you say, shoving the distraught slider all the way up to 11. "He's been in an accident, hasn't he?" There's another cop coming down the staircase, and they're going into full-on sit-down-and-have-a-cup-of-tea mode, as if they expect you to go into shock. "What makes you think there's been an accident?" asks Brown. But it's just a residual autonomic cop reflex. He's already bought your spiel on outline. "Mike's big on water sports," you say offhand, then make to look horrified. "Oh, God! What's happened?" "I'm really sorry." PC Brown looks sideways at the newcomer, Detective Sergeant Green. "Yeah, right," you think. "There's been a fatality, sir. We're still trying to ascertain the precise nature of events." Which means it wasn't an accident. "I'm sorry to intrude on your grief, sir, but if you don't mind, I'd like to take a saliva sample." They've already got your fingerprint biometrics off the driving license. This means they're serious about logging identities. You nod shakily. "Sure. Oh, God." You hunch up a little and do the weepy thing. Not too much of it. You don't want to ham it up and tip them off. "I can't believe it." Which is entirely true. Mikey's dossier says he's never been involved in anything serious enough to warrant a hit. That was one of the reasons you were going to interview him. Walking in on a homicide investigation is classic dumb bad luck. Your immediate task is to stop it graduating into a classic fuck-up, which is best done by cooperating with the cops for the time being. There are forms you can serve later to get John Christie's DNA taken off the database once they figure out that he's an innocent bystander. Then you can retire the ID with a do-not-recycle flag. Brown produces a sample tube and a cotton swab and invites you to say, "Ah," which you do with alacrity. After which it's all tea and sympathy, minus the tea, and, "We're terribly sorry, you're free to go, sir," after they get you to repeat in front of their specs that you haven't seen Mike for at least half a year. And why shouldn't you be free to go? John Christie is simply a contact whose state-issued biometric ID checks out, who has donated a DNA sample for the investigation, and who is at best an embarrassing distraction from the job in hand. You leave by the front door and pedal very slowly, being careful to wobble for the cameras until you're out of sight of the house. There's been a fatality. Hence all the plastic sheeting and the DNA swab dance routine. We're still trying to ascertain the precise nature of events, which means it wasn't an accident. Accidents don't call for a detective sergeant to cover the site. Something has gone seriously fucking wrong here, and it looks like you may need to abort the operation, close up shop, and leave town on the schedule you just fed the police. But first, you've got a fallback option. You bicycle away from the former abode of Michael Blair, your mood very dark. Somehow, all the fun has been sucked out of this venture before it even got started. Number one client had the supreme bad taste to get himself whacked at a maximally inconvenient time. You've still got a job of work to do, but the hotel lost your luggage, and on top of that you've got the added vexation of falling within the penumbra of police surveillance, which will take some work to get disentangled from when it's time to leave. Luckily, ironically, you haven't done anything illegal yet. All you have to do is be John Christie for a week, then switch to another primary ID and stay clean while the paperwork to pull his DNA off the system chugs along. It's not like you're a serial killer or anything, is it? But it's still a nuisance. So you decide to execute your fallback plan and visit your number two client. While you were doing the weepy in front of PC Brown, the sun came out and most of the clouds have fucked off to Glasgow. Alas, there's a brisk breeze blowing. You can die of sunburn and hypothermia during a Scottish summer, simultaneously, with added insomnia on top from the midnight sun. It goes below the horizon, but it never really gets dark. Swearing at the weather under your breath, you cycle uphill into the wind for half a kilometre, then pause at a cycle rack to ditch the wheels. Once you're clear of the pedal-powered snitch, you can safely reboot the phone and hit the online maps for a route to number two client. Actually, you're querying for a route to the boutique chocolate shop in Fountainbridge, above which they live and run their business. Another way to avoid cropping up in a cop space crawl. But no matter. You haven't memorized this particular route because you expected to be holed up with Mikey Boy for the whole morning and a chunk of the afternoon, but again, no matter. Your candidate for chief operations officer may have drawn the ace of spades, but you're still holding a card for the CFO. And, according to the dossier head office sent you, Vivian works from home. The police know you're in town, so hiding your trail may actually be a bad idea at this point. Accordingly, you hoof it to the nearest bus stop and call the micro. While you wait for it, you review what the operation knows about her, and is willing to stick in a mangled bitmap image file on an offshore cloud. Vivian Crowler, age 48, single, chartered accountant by trade, not so much an adornment to her profession as a butt-nugget dangling from its arse-hairs. She has been investigated by the ACA Disciplinary Committee 3 times, but escaped unscathed save for a reprimand on the first occasion, now timed out. She's been investigated by the Revenue 2 times, inconclusively. She has come to the attention of the Serious Fraud Office and escaped without receiving as much as a police caution. She's so slippery, you could skin her and market the hide as a surface for frying pans. And that's just her public persona. What the operation knows about Vivian is enough that if you were with the police, you'd be smacking your chops and writing her up for the Procurator Fiscal, while mentally drafting the press release. When she was the guerrilla's banker, she ran the most efficient money-laundering operation ever seen north of Hadrian's Wall, and if it wasn't for the ongoing deflationary spiral and a slightly embarrassing problem repatriating her overseas assets while under the nose of the revenue, she'd be living in a castle in Fife with a helicopter and pilot for the weekly shopping trips to Jenner's. As it is, you figure she's only marking time until she retires in style, at which point she'll leg it to Palermo, where they have retirement homes stacked to the ceiling with her type of merry widow. The bus, when it comes, is empty. You hole up in what used to be the driver's seat, and it moves off silently. It's a great way to tour the Athens of the North, and you watch entranced as it rolls over the speed pillows and cobblestones on its way southeast. You've bid a fiver for a route divert, and for a miracle there's no other money bags aboard to up the ante. It's going to take you close to Vivian's front door. Now, this scene is one you haven't rehearsed for, and so you're going to have to play it with a certain delicacy. But it's not rocket science. You've got a handle on Vivian and her history. She's even worked for the operation before, unwittingly at a lower level, but nonetheless. There are strings to pull, but she's an experienced player, predictable up to a point. That's why you were leaving her for the second interview. The bus whines as it crawls up the slope, then totters anemically along Lothian Road, stopping to pick up and put down the usual losers along the way. You keep yourself buttoned up, avoiding eye contact. Back home? It'd be a stretch limo with tinted windows all the way. But a start-up job in Scotland calls for the people's car, and plenty of warm bodies to get lost among. It rolls slowly past your hotel, then the row of pompous fin de siècle bank frontages thrown up a couple of decades since and now half boarded over. Then, at the big five-way intersection, it hangs a right, and your phone pleeps a set-down alert at you. 120 meters to destination. Fucking bus company. You start walking. This part of town has an uneasy relationship with affluence. Besides the obligatory state-owned Tesco local, there's a weird mix of closed and barricaded shopfronts, charity stores with windows stuffed full of last decade's brown leather sofas, and imaginative little boutiques selling upmarket tchotchkes. You pass a kebab shop and an Asian jewellery store before you reach the chocolatier and the usual anonymous black door beside it. There is a buzzer. You mash your thumb on the button for the flat 1F2 and wait. And wait. After a minute, you push it again and hold. Just your luck if Vivian's chosen this lunchtime to go do her shopping. There's no reply, but the door opens in your face. A young guy slithers past you, earbuds screwed in as tight as his closed face. You catch the door with your toe, and a moment later you're on your way upstairs. The tenement stairwell is grey and dusty, worn flagstones and black-enamelled cast-iron handrails leading up into the gloom. On the first-floor landing you find three heavy-looking doorways. The tarnished brass nameplate saying Crawler Associates tells you all you need to know, and you push the doorbell beside it. There is, as you expected, no response. You stand, holding your breath. Well, you've come all this way. Why stop here? There's a multifunction pen in your pocket. It doesn't look like anything special, but there are five cartridges and a bunch of complicated springs inside that barrel. And there's a wallet in your other pocket, and along with a phone and driving license, it contains a couple of other cards, one of which might have raised an eyebrow if the police had dumpster-dived your pockets and thought to peel away the laminated stickers to reveal the intricately etched sheet of fullerene-reinforced plastic within. But even then it's not obvious what the etching is, and you've got an explanation for how you came by it that would get you off the hook under most circumstances. Except these. You take 30 seconds to twist and warp some springy bits of steel-tough plastic free from the card, another 20 seconds to swap them in place of the ballpoint cartridge, and 10 seconds to bump the lock. Then you step inside Vivian Crawler's apartment. You let the door slip shut behind you, and in that very instant you realize that something is irrevocably awry. It's never entirely quiet in a Scottish tenement flat. The floorboard creaking footfalls of upstairs unseen neighbours. The drone of a news channel on next door's PC. If the windows look out over the front, there's the interminable road noise of a major thoroughfare, muted now by last century's standards, but still present. The faint susurration of arctic methane flowing through the pipe to the fuel cell. The whir of the refrigerator in the kitchen. The windows face out back, the neighbours are at work, and you can't hear the fridge. Is that all? There's a faint hissing from somewhere. You glance up. The illumination filtering into the rectangular central hall comes through open doorways, and it has the numinous tint of daylight. You take your picklock card and use its edge to delicately swipe the light switch, leaving no prints. "Vivian?" you call quietly. There's a strong floral stink in the flat, as from one of those fucking air fresheners women like to put in the bathroom to make out that they shit roses. "Vivian?" you ask again, walking towards the living room. "I got your email." "Vivian?" There's a scrap of paper on the floor. You frown and bend down to pick it up. It's white, overprinted in mostly green ink, with faint yellow and pink tints, approximately 6 centimetres by 12 in size. You remember it's like from your childhood. It's a foreign banknote. The Royal Bank of Scotland, PLC, promised to pay the bearer on demand £1 sterling. At their head office here in Edinburgh, by order of the board, 30th of March, 1999. Dead words, dead currency, dead bank, broken promise. Inside the austerely furnished living room, there lies a mattress. It has been cocooned in shrink-wrap plastic, sealed against the elements. The fragile husk of Vivian Crowler forms a mound under the polythene integument, like a pupa bonded to the surface of a leaf. She's barely 1.50 metres in her stockinged feet, grey-haired and thin, as if all the juices of life unlived have been sucked out of her. She's neatly dressed in a dark suit and pearl necklace, all present and correct, but for a missing shoe and a premature death. There is a rip in the side of the shrink wrap, a deep gash that plunges into the interior of the mattress, from which irredeemable green ink promises bleed halfway across the carpet. Damn her! Why couldn't she have stuffed her mattress with 50 euro notes instead of unrecyclable toilet paper? A corner of you thinks irreverently. You bend close to her and touch her shoulder through the plastic. She's cold and stiff. Someone obviously shrink-wrapped her onto the mattress while she was unconscious or already dead. But who and why? Rising, you stalk through the kitchen, her office, the bathroom. The stink in the bathroom is chokingly thick, almost unbreathable. The electronic air freshener is farting away like a cow with irritable bowel syndrome. You lick your dry lips. "This isn't funny anymore," you complain, an ironic meta-commentary on your internal turmoil. Then the true state of jeopardy slams into you like a railway spike of purest distilled paranoia, and you see with merciless clarity. Someone has gotten inside your decision loop. They're a rival or an enemy. They've identified and killed your chosen COO and CFO hours or days before you were ready to make them employment offers. They're sending you a message. Get out of town. Get out of town now. Run away, little businessman, while there's still time. You can't get out of town even if you want to. The police have got your DNA on file as belonging to John Christie, a contact of Mike Blair, deceased. You need to dance the John Christie is an innocent bystander fandango until you can serve the paperwork to get your samples destroyed, or your usefulness to the operation will be at an end, and with it, your career. To make matters worse, you're here now. Vivian Crowler isn't going to vanish silently from Scottish society without anyone asking questions. Sooner or later, one of her business associates or relatives or nosy neighbours will crawl whimpering to the public servants, who will break down her door, pinch the bridge of their nose beneath suddenly watering eyes, and call for CID and forensics. And then it'll be déjà vu all over again, and you'd better hope you're not shedding flakes of dead skin, because if they get a sequence match linking you to both scenes... You begin to sidle back towards the front door, shuddering beneath the livid call of rage that has settled over your shoulders, all the while thinking, once is happenstance, but twice is enemy action. Someone's going to bleed for this, and it's not going to be you. Liz. Snowballing Hell. Thursday morning dawns moist and miserable. You turn yourself out of bed, scramble two eggs, and remember to bag up the plastic waste for collection on your way out the door. Then, 40 minutes before you're due on shift, your phone pulls on its work personality and rings for you. It's Moxie. This can only be trouble. Skipper! He screws his face up like a hamster worried you're going to steal his peanut. You decent? You take your thumb off the camera. I was about to head in. What's come up? I think you want to be here 30 minutes ago. It's about that wave you were tracking with ISIS. I got a call from a lieutenant in the Dresden Kripo. He's trying to get in touch with you urgently about an investigation. Mox's bamboozled befuddlement isn't unreasonable. Death in Deutschland isn't a regular bullet point on your daily team briefings. I'll call him as soon as I'm in the office. You pause. Anything else? Yes. Chief Inspector McLeish wants to see you. It's about the Blair case. He's raising a request for research and says it's priority one. Screamingly urgent, in other words. Well, ping him and tell him I'm in transit. You hang up and neck your coffee, burn your tongue, swear in an extremely unladylike manner as you grab for a glass of tap water, then run through your checklist and are out the door in record time. You make it to the end of the road as a minibus trundles away from the stop, swear again, and drop the ghost of a tenner on its icon. For a miracle, it accepts the bid, whines to a halt, and kneels as you run to catch up. The other passengers glare irritably at you as you climb aboard, slightly breathless. You take a seat, then realise you left your hairbrush at home. So, another bad hair day is already underway. There's no hurrying the bus as it meanders around the back streets, diverting to pick folks up and drop them off. Sooner or later, your work-subsidised travel pass will get you to the office. But unlike a taxi, there's no quality of service guarantee and no privacy. So you're left tapping your fingers in frustration, unwilling to log into CopSpace in public, because you're an inspector and your work is a wee bit more confidential than J. Random Plod's notebook. There's a lot at stake if your desktop leaks. So much for telecommuting. Policing is one of those jobs that will always revolve around a meat space hub, if only because you can't build a cell block in cyberspace. So it is that you arrive at work at 8:42 a.m, ahead of your start of shift and in a timely manner, but disastrously out of touch with the events unfolding around you. Your first inkling that this may be something worse than a regular bad hair day comes as you step down off the bus and walk towards the front entrance in Fettes Avenue. They unwired the police HQ comprehensively back in the teens. Consequently, it senses your approach and it knows how to get your attention. The left arm of your spectacles vibrates for attention, and you instinctively touch your phone in acknowledgement. Blinking arrows glide urgently across the powder-blue furnishings in the waiting area, urging you inward. Go to room D31. Babylon briefing to commence in 15. What on earth? You barely have time to wonder before a blizzard of post-its spring up, occluding nearly every hard surface in sight, and you see the grisly news. Dickie has added you to the team investigating the Mike Blair murder. You whistle tunelessly through your front teeth and straighten up, then head towards the meat space incident room. There's a list of 50-odd officers on the case, from constables up to the DCI himself, and probably a super watching over his shoulder and demanding hourly updates for the PR flacks at the Ministry of Justice. As you expected, Mikey's double wetsuit misadventure has gone political, on top of the usual three-ring circus that shows up for every murder case. It's the one crime for which all the police forces of the former United Kingdom pull out all the stops. But the 95% clean-up rate you take a justifiable pride in comes at a ruinous multi-million euro expense. Access to CopSpace, an augmented reality overlay that maps a view of the criminal intel knowledge base across the physical world in front of your eyes, doesn't make police stations with control centres and briefing rooms obsolete. Quite the contrary. It's not so long ago that you and your colleagues were plunged into the collective nightmare of a total breach of network security and had to fall back to prepaid supermarket mobis and passing around notes printed on manual typewriters. Maintaining a physical command centre is vital. Policing requires systematic teamwork, which means communication. And even when they're working, online conferencing systems just aren't quite good enough to make face-to-face meetings obsolete. Working teleconferencing is right around the corner, just like food pills, the flying car, and energy too cheap to meter. There's a scrum in the corridor outside D31, so you hang back a bit and wait for it to disperse. Then Moxie shows up. Skipper. He nods, sketchy acknowledgement, and you nod back. What's the story? You ask him. Moxie's gaze flickers sidelong, taking in the neighbours. He clears his throat. Lieutenant Hayner from Dresden really wants to talk about his suspected homicide, Skipper, so I... Homicide? You ask. I thought the victim was in hospital. Died overnight. Moxie shrugs uncomfortably. There's also a Sergeant Nobile from the Gruppo Anticrimine Tecnologico in Rome who wants to bend your ear urgently. Oh, Jesus! You rack your brains. What force is he with? Wait a sec. Moxie's looking it up in the directory. You could have done it yourself. You just thought he might have done the legwork already. It's part of the Guardia di Finanza, the National Financial Customs and Economic Police. He looks slightly boggled, eyes twitching as he saccades through the infodump. They also do cybercrime. He's on the Europol R34 distribution. Says it's about the homicide in Dresden and, He nods at the front of the queue, which is beginning to shuffle into Max briefing. An associated murder in Trieste. There's more. That feedstock you were looking for. It'll have to wait. There's the usual pre-calf mumbled meet and greet in the doorway. Then you're in and looking for a free seat near the back. Not fast enough. McLeish is waiting just inside and makes eye contact. Inspector... He nods. Subsequent words flow like grit through engine oil. You were right. Thanks for forwarding me that case. You show him your best Botox face. It's a moment to take home and treasure, but you're not going to waste your brownie points gloating in the middle of a murder investigation. I gather a bunch more contacts have come in overnight. Well, this is really fucking abnormal, if you'll pardon my French. Never seen anything like it. Me neither, you concede. What do you need from ICIU? All your Bing and Google mojo, and a pipe into Europol. Oh, and anything you know about grey market Faba feedstock. Why don't you sit in the front row? After that, there's no escape.
Morning, peeps.
Dodgy Dicky stands before a plain white wall bearing the Lothian and Borders logo, and below it a new name, Operation Babylon. The atmosphere in the room is expectant and just a little angry. One-third suits, one-third boots, and a mash-up of civilian support specialists.
We've got a murder. Not your normal Ned-on-Ned stabby, unfortunately. This one's got legs. We're out of the Golden 48.
He means the first 2 days of the investigation. And to make matters worse, D.I. Kavanagh, who first clocked it as a culpable homicide, has drawn some really disturbing parallels with at least two other killings and an ongoing investigation into contraband supplies.
What?
You wonder, puzzled. Then an IM sidles into your specs. It's Moxie. Sorry, Skipper. Mac asked about grey fabs and incoming cases.
Well, that tears it.
Dicky is ahead of you on your own portfolio. You'd turn and glare at your sergeant, only he's wisely decided that discretion is the better part of valour, and staked out a corner at the back.
Great.
Here's the situation.
The wall behind Dodgy Dicky does a wipe to reveal Mikey's bathroom death scene.
Note the victim is taped and gagged. It's set up to resemble an accidental autoerotic fatality. The thing he's plumbed into is a mid-1960s colonic irrigation machine, a collector's piece formerly owned by the late Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. Apparently, he insisted on daily enemas.
Note the evidence of sexual stimulation. The enema fluid contains a borderline toxic concentration of a medicine usually prescribed for impotence, but that's not what killed him. Mr. Blair is HIV positive and on multi-drug maintenance. He also has hypertension and is on meds for that condition. Pathology tells us that one of the protease inhibitors he's on interacts very badly with Viagra. And the full workup D.I. Kavanagh ordered tells us that what he had in his system at the time was his prescription cocktail and a buttload of Viagra. But again, that's not what killed him.
Mac glances at you, his face unreadable.
The proximate cause of death was cardiac arrest, so we ordered a full workup on the enema fluid, so pathology went trawling for known pharmaceuticals. They can do that these days. They've got lab-on-a-chip analyzers that can identify thousands of drugs in microgram quantities. Or so they told you on the last research course you did on organic forensics.
What they found was his prescription meds and the Viagra, and one last thing. The enema fluid was loaded with grapefruit juice.
Grapefruit juice?
You see winces going round the audience. Dicky continues, I'm told that grapefruit juice is a catastrophe waiting to happen if you're on certain types of blood pressure medicine. It interferes with them, just as badly as Viagra interferes with protease inhibitors.
What we've got is a cocktail of drug interactions, Viagra and ritonavir, which massively increased the effect of the Viagra,
which depresses the user's blood pressure, and grapefruit juice doing much the same to his ACE inhibitor. He looks at his notes. I'm told the grapefruit juice alone would have had the effect of causing a severe drop in blood pressure lasting a few hours. Add a cocktail of Viagra and Ritonavir, and Professor Davis is of the opinion it'd be enough to push him over the edge. As chief pathologist, Professor Davis ought to know. What's interesting is, who knew about Blair's prescription and worked out precisely what to slip in his happy juice? And who helped Mr. Blair into his underwear? We'd really like to know the answer to that one. But it's not the only lead I want us to follow up. You're doing your best to keep your Botox face in place. Otherwise, your eyebrows would be halfway to merging with your hairline. Dodgy Dickie McLeish is solid, unimaginative, and methodical. If he's hairing off in search of a homicidal pharmacist, then either somebody's slipped him a Mickey Finn, or all simpler explanations have already been ruled out, which is very bad news. SOC did a complete sweep of the premises, Dickie continues. In the process, they found these. He flicks up a picture of a wooden shelf bracketed to a whitewashed brick wall. A cellar, of course. There's a neat row of sealed black canisters along it. You swear under your breath. You've seen their like before, fly-tipped in on-street recycling bins all over town. Faber cartridges. Unchipped, cheap knock-offs of the official product. These ones are all full of high-temperature thermosetting granules, presumably bound for a contraband factory somewhere in Edinburgh. They're untraceable and illegal, and their presence suggests a connection to an ongoing investigation of D.I. Kavanaugh's. You sit there, quietly fuming as Dickie rolls unconcernedly away from his ambush of your unfunded project. If you'd actually been able to devote resources to following up the empties for the black market Faber trade, you might have got to Mikey before someone killed him. Anyway, this is where things get weird. The wall scrolls sideways to reveal a different bathroom demise. This scene's helpfully labelled in German, as you recognise from the six-syllable train wreck attached to the tanning salon sunbed. Dresden, Germany. This is the bathroom of Markus Hassler, a fine upstanding son of the city with a background in pharmaceutical spam, illegal sale of medicinal products, and counterfeit goods. That is a sunbed. At the same time our Mr. Blair was being plumbed into his personal jet wash, give or take a couple of hours, Mr. Hassler apparently drank half a litre of schnapps spiked with tranquilizers and climbed inside his sunbed, the control circuitry of which had been modified to override the safety shutoffs. He died in hospital yesterday without regaining consciousness. There's a low muttering and shuffling going on around you, and you nod, unconsciously picking up on the vibe, the rest of the room realizing they're in an out-of-Kansas situation. McLeish continues implacably. Both Mike Blair and Markus Hassler had prior conviction records in much the same field of criminal expertise. They died in not dissimilar manners as a result of incidents that commenced within 3 hours of each other. He shifts from foot to foot. There are reports of other similar deaths in different jurisdictions this morning, that is, of persons involved in illegal network marketing activities dying in circumstances superficially resembling domestic incidents. Dickie catches your eye. I'd like to thank D.I. Kavanaugh for drawing the initial match to my attention, and Sergeant Cunningham for flagging the additional cases that came in while Liz was off shift. Well, that's torn it. And so, yet again, Moxie escapes a well-deserved bollocking for playing fast and loose with the chain of command. As of this meeting, we're continuing the investigation into the Michael Blair homicide. However, we're going to have to recognise the need to integrate into a larger Europol investigation into the multiple parallel killings of at least two, and possibly many more convicted criminals across member state borders. And that's why I've invited D.I. Kavanagh to run the international liaison side of the investigation and provide input on the possible bootleg Faber connection. He's got you, willy-nilly, drafted back into a CID murder investigation, and fuck your existing caseload and understaffed department. And there's no way he can't know what he's doing to your performance metrics. Dicky is clearly out to get you. Once is happenstance, but twice is enemy action. Someone's going to bleed for this, and it's not going to be you. The bloody hell did you think you were? Wasn't it my fault, Skipper? It's tagged priority. Doing going around the 1, mandatory escalate, so I pushed it at the duty inspector, and he, chain of command. Moxie raises his hands in surrender, right as your frustrated snarl runs down. You glance around, then you stare into his eyes, hard. Run that past me again. Moxie swallows. Like I said, it was an urgent request for input on a homicide investigation. You were off shift, and there was a no-delay flag on it. Golden 48, so I pointed it at the duty desk. I haven't been telling tales out of school to dodgy Skipper. Please, what would you have done? I'd have... Fuck! You restrain the urge to punch the corridor wall and draw a deep breath instead. The trouble is, Moxie isn't wrong. Who is on the duty desk? It was Inspector Rodney, ma'am. Sheila Rodney, who doesn't, as far as you know, carry a knife for your back, but who knows well enough to forward a lead to the Blair murder investigation. Fuck! You take another deep breath. Grab yourself a coffee, then see me in my office in 15 minutes. You heard what Dicky said. That means your workload just doubled for the rest of the week, so let's go run through it before I have to go talk to the Europol investigators. 15 minutes? If I'm being pulled off ICIU for the duration, I've got to brief Doc Green. Moxie looks at you as if your dog just died, and you don't have the heart to stay angry. You give him a gentle shove on the shoulder. Get going, Sergeant. There's more than enough shit to go round this time. And then you head upstairs, across the walkway, into the adjacent block, and around the corner to Chief Inspector Dixon's wee office. George Dockreen Dixon is A, your nominal superior, and B, not interested in the day-to-day running of ICIU, out with its potential to dump embarrassing shit in his lap without warning. George is old school, trained up via computer forensics to occupy a trusted niche in CID, trawling paedophiles' phones for evidence of thought crime, while keeping one foot in the stirrup of the runaway horse that is infrastructure IT. He doesn't have much time for ICIU, especially after the time he dropped round when you weren't in, and Moxie showed him the Goatsy dance video, followed by a brisk web tour of the shock sites of Lothian and Borders, culminating in the infamous penile degloving accident fan site, which apparently left him with PTSD and permanent scarring on the insides of his eyelids. Ever since, he's been more than happy to leave you alone to run your little fiefdom as you see fit. George is a very, very busy man, as he never tires of reminding you from behind the cover of his salt and pepper moustache. He probably thinks his manner is avuncular. You think it's patronising, but it's not your job to pass comment. In any case, he's effective. Before Dodgy Dicky dissolved the morning briefing, You'd already emailed Doc to beg a minute of his time, so you have no compunction about going straight round to IIT and hammering on his battered office door.
Enter!
Doc looks up as you open the door. For a moment you think he's playing a Sims game on his desk, then you recognise the new annex over the road. Sims, yes, but it's some kind of architectural model. He's probably looking for a way to shoehorn more bandwidth through the crumbling concrete walls.
Have a seat. What's come up this time, Liz?
You can't help yourself. You pull a face.
Have you been following Dickie McLeish's murder investigation, sir?
No.
He raises an eyebrow that looks like it's got a sleeping caterpillar glued to it.
Should I have?
It's a crawling horror. First, it's gone political. Secondly, it looks like it's not a one-off. We've had contacts from Europol about similar killings in Germany and possibly Italy. It's a Three Sigma match or better. If they hadn't happened simultaneously, we'd be looking for a serial killer. Anyway, the initial lead-in came in via ICIU, and there's an input angle from one of my current cases, so Dickie just upped and announced that he's drafting me to coordinate with the foreign investigators, without so much as a by your leave.
Well, that's nice to know, George says heavily. Did he ask you first?
You shake your head. I'm not happy, sir, but it's a murder case and a high-profile one. It'd look bad if I kicked up a fuss. A long pause.
What do you want to do?
You do not fail to spot the emphasis. What I'd like to do is to get on with running my unit, sir. It's not as if we're short of work right now. Trouble is, he framed it as a fait accompli. If you want me to hold the fort, I'm going to need some backup. Another pause.
What are your alternative options?
You hunch your shoulders uncomfortably. I can shovel a bunch of routine stuff off onto Moxie and Speedy. If I hold back about 8 hours a week for ICIU, shelve my skills matrix update sessions indefinitely, and bail on as much paperwork as possible, then I can probably give Dickie and the investigation 3.5 out of 5 shifts a week for the rest of the month. I think the unit can function without my hands on the tiller for that long, assuming nothing unusual pops out of the woodwork. But it's going to be touch and go. All it would take would be one of my sergeants being off sick for a week, or another case like the Morningside Cannibals coming out of left field. The Morningside Cannibals, a circle of polite middle-class people who dined out on each other with the aid of a medical tissue incubator tank. Figuring out what on earth to charge them with, cannibalism not being illegal in Scotland, was the least of your worries when the blogs moved in. In the end, they were reported to the Procurator Fiscal for outraging public decency and corpse desecration. A flimsy case, as the defence barristers pointed out in court, given that the dinner parties in question were strictly private affairs, and the human flesh on the plates had been cloned from ladies who were not only still alive, but willing to testify that their own cultured meat tasted nothing like chicken. In the end, the case had collapsed amidst recriminations and calls for a change in the law. Mention of the Morningside Cannibals has the desired effect. Doc winces visibly.
Aye, well, Liz, that's as may be, but let's not pile up speculative obstacles before we get to them.
He leans forward.
It sounds to me like Dodgy Dickie has got your number. Best not fight him in public. Leave him to me. I'll have a wee chat with Jackie Somerville and shake some resources loose from her department in return for your loan.
He fixes you with a gimlet stare.
Just Promise me you didn't fix this up to weasel your way back onto a CID case. You shake your head vigorously. Boss, would I do a thing like that? You catch his expression. That's live rail territory. With respect, sir, if I wanted to apply for a transfer back to CID, you'd hear about it before it happened, and I'd be doing it with your say-so or not at all. Anything else would be grossly unprofessional conduct detrimental to the smooth running of the chain of command, not to mention a real own goal career-wise. Right? A long pause, then Doc nods. Exactly so, Inspector. I'm glad we understand each other. So am I, sir. Get out of my office. He waves genially to diffuse the curt dismissal. Leave Dickie to me. Just be sure to set your house in order before you go herring off in all directions, and keep me fully informed. Dismissed. You get the hell out of Doc's office, and you're halfway back to the ICIU before you pause to wonder whether you're being set up, or whether this really is your route back into CID after your long exile on the Rule 34 squad. Moxie is waiting for you in your office, and, for a miracle, he's brought you a mug of latte just the way you like it. He's wearing an appropriately sheepish expression, which finally makes your mind up for you. Chill, Moxie. I'm not happy, but it's not your fault. Next time, try to give me some warning, okay? He looks relieved. I wanted to, Skipper, but Chief Inspector McLeish scheduled you for the briefing before I could get to you. Before he could get to you through regular channels, he means, but you don't pursue the point. I've just had a little chat with Chief Inspector Dixon. He's going to try and square things with the Deputy Superintendent to get some backup in here. But in the meantime, it looks like Dickie's little empire-building gambit is working. I'm going to be very scarce around here for the rest of the month, or until Dickie gets his man. So, how about we go over what you've got on your desk, what I've got on mine that's going to be added to your caseload while I'm gone, and what extra resources you need to keep your head above water in the meantime? Yes? Dawning horror steals across Mox's face. What? You're leaving me in charge? Up to a point. I'll still be around, but only for about an hour a day. Rule number one, always budget 50% more time for your people than you tell them you've got. Think hard before you escalate. Speed is off today. I'll be repeating this chat with him when he's back in. You're going to have to coordinate with him directly, not through me. Meanwhile, your caseload, show it to me. For about the next hour, Moxie subjects you to his team's current caseload in all its mind-numbingly recondite, not to mention perverse, detail. Publicity surrounding the Morningside Cannibals has led to a spate of copycat offences against sanity, some of them literally so. As in, there are folks dining on cloned haunch of pedigree Siamese tonight. There's an anonymous perp randomly posting upskirt videos on neighbourhood blogs, captured by a microcam strapped to one of the two tame squirrels in the botanic gardens. Mox is looking for the fabosource of some disturbingly simple meth lab in a brick chemistry kits that are circulating among the usual numpties in Loch End. And there's the regular slew of urban legend queries from the more gullible elements of CID to field. There's the hentai fan base to keep an eye on, with their current interest in Hitler yaoi and Holocaust tentacle porn, still illegal in Germany, which is giving rise to cross-jurisdictional headaches, and their ongoing attempt to exhaustively explore the M-Girls N-Cups polynomial space in NP time, as a computer geek of your acquaintance once put it. You're not quite sure what the NP time bit means,
but the combination of cheap machinima tools and lots of unemployed games programmers have turned Edinburgh into a hotbed of photorealistic fetish video production, even though it's technically illegal. The burden of evidence is higher under Scottish law, so despite having tougher porn laws than England, the smart shock site developers have all moved north, while their development tools and websites have migrated into the Russian blacknet cloud. Fighting it is an unwinnable battle, so your job is merely to flag up anything involving real live actors, especially minors, and try to avoid unwittingly popularizing the stuff via the Streisand effect. At the end of the hour, you're just about reeling from the deluge, but you've given Moxie a framework for prioritizing his jobs over the next week, not to mention your home and personal mobile numbers, and strict instructions to call you immediately if anything really fucked comes up. You can see he's getting psyched up, ready and prepared to perform triage on Tub Girl should the need make itself known, right up until the moment your Moby rings. You answer it. It's Dodgy Dicky. Shit.
Wait one.
You mouth at Moxie.
Yes.
McLeish looks like his ulcer's playing up again.
Inspector, are you up to speed on the international angle yet?
You bite back your instant reaction. I'm in the process of clearing my desk and handing off all current ICIU operations to a subordinate. It's going to take me another half hour today and a couple of hours tomorrow when my relief sergeant is in the shop. So your answer is a conditional no, sir. Has something come up?
You bet it has, and it's touching down at Turnhouse in an hour. We've got an investigator from Europol flying in to poke his nose where it doesn't belong. I want you to meet him and keep him the hell off my back. Is that understood?
Your instant impulse is to tell Dickie to fuck right off, but the prospect of subsequently explaining your language to a disciplinary tribunal isn't attractive. I understand you consider my management of a secure handoff of my departmental responsibilities is less important than what is basically a babysitting job, sir. I'm going to comply with your request, but not at the cost of making a hash of a bunch of other, admittedly lower priority, investigations that are already in progress. I'll take care of the busybodies, but you don't tell me how to run my unit. Am I clear? For a moment, Dickie looks as if he's about to blow a gasket, but then he nods jerkily.
Perfectly.
Good. You hang up and check your desktop. Sure enough, there's a stack of busybody IMs that have come in while you were briefing Moxie, insistently asking for you and demanding that you do this, do that, hither and yon. Dickie's management style is to shoot at the monkey's feet, make the monkey dance. Especially when the monkey was, 10 years ago, number one in his graduating class, and as recently as 5 years ago, the number one candidate for the post he is currently occupying. You rub your eyes. I'm too old for this shit, you hear yourself say.
Skipper,
Moxie is looking at you. Anything I can do to help?
No, just as long as you're clear on where we're going. I've got to go to the airport to meet a flight in. Cover my back.
He sketches a video game rendition of a salute.
Yes, ma'am.
Cool. You finish reading the IM stack. Then your tenuous control fractures like a sheet of toughened glass held for too long over a naked flame of rage as you see your contact details.
Shit!
Skipper?
That's all I fucking need this morning. All!
What?
Nothing you can do, Moxie.
You get a handle on it fast, but for a moment you're blurring with bloody-eyed rage. Because you recognize the name on the passenger manifest, the Eurocop who's coming to visit, and who Dodgy Dickie has detailed you to organize the disposition of. It's the man who cost you your career 5 years ago.
Kamal!